We had no background in education, right. And we thought to ourselves, okay, as a private sector company or as a startup, how would we solve the same problem for ourselves? And when we took that product to market, our audience was like, this is so different, this is amazing, this is neat. And for us, we were like, well, that's just a basic product that we would have done for ourselves, right?
Welcome to The Conversation. This is your host, Matt Price, coming back from a bit of a vacation through April. Had a sickness and then a couple other conferences to attend, but we're back here May 1st talking with Justin George, the founder and CEO of Aptigy. Welcome, Justin. We're glad to have you today.
Thanks, Matt. Glad to be here.
Justin, why don't you give us a quick little description of what Aptigy is and then who kind of your core customers are.
Sure. At Aptigy, we build a messaging and marketing platform for schools. And our primary market is K-12, and we sell to schools and school districts all across the United States.
Okay. So when you're working with schools, what problem are you trying to solve that they have?
Sure. So a big thing that's happening in the education landscape is there's a lot of legislative changes that are happening, whether it's transferring between districts, school choice laws, vouchers. With all things that are happening, the role of the superintendent is really changing to more of a private sector CEO, to where that's not necessarily what they were trained to do. So communications is a big piece, but we believe that marketing is going to be a big part of how school districts are run, and they're going to be run more like private companies. And we felt like with the private sector experience that we have, we could actually build a lot of those tools and help them compete in a much more competitive education landscape.
Right. So that's a pretty sophisticated approach you guys are taking. So you know, you hinted at your private sector experience and that of your team. Can you tell us a little bit about the experience that you have and what kind of led you to seeing the need for something like Aptigy?
Sure. Before this, I actually had a direct marketing business that we were able to have a successful exit from in 2011. Before that, I've always been in some type of sales or sales management or marketing role, right? And so this was right up my alley. But at my last business, I was wanting to get into software. Didn't know exactly what that meant, but I set up a little agency and just started taking on some side projects.
Right.
And during that time, my nephew was in kindergarten, and we'd find out, oh, wait, he'd have a play tomorrow or even today. And my wife and I are just thinking to ourselves, there's got to be a better way to keep up with this kid.
Yeah, yeah.
And the first question was, does the school not have an app? And then that question basically spurred this entire journey. Started digging in and saw an opportunity. At the time, if we had built a marketing platform right from the beginning, a lot of our audience would have said, oh, that's great. Come back to us in 3 years. So we needed to enter the market. And something that was really important for us to build a marketing platform was to get control of communications first. And so we started off with the communication aspect and get our feet wet in the education market and then transition that into more of a marketing platform, which is going to be a big need for school districts moving forward.
Right. So it's interesting that you said your experiences in sales management and marketing. Selling into the educational space is a notoriously difficult prospect. You're talking about schools that don't have big budgets. You're talking about folks that aren't real, I don't want to say not versed in technology, but aren't necessarily on the cutting edge. So talk to me a little bit about how you approached, because, you know, when you're building a business around a customer where you've got a really long sales cycle, how you approach that? Like how did you see that? Because I'm sure you're smart enough to know that that was going to be an issue getting into it. How did you see that and how did you overcome that?
I'm not saying this is good advice, but this is what worked for us. It's really interesting when you enter a market that you don't have experience in. Mm-hmm. On the product side, what's interesting about it is if you're really deep into it, you say, oh, this doesn't work, this doesn't work. How do we improve that? And you end up making those 10 or 15% incremental improvements on what existed. Mm-hmm. We had no background in education, right. And we thought to ourselves, okay, as a private sector company or as a startup, how would we solve the same problem for ourselves? And when we took that product to market, our audience was like, this is so different, this is amazing, this is neat. And for us, we were like, well, that's just a basic product that we would have done for ourselves, right? The same thing happens on the sales side. We did not know how sales to education works. So we started talking to people and understanding, okay, you got these RFP processes and bid processes, and you're going to have 6-month sales cycles, and then it's a market that doesn't have money and all these reasons. So we thought to ourselves very early on, we're not interested in how people sell to education. And we're just going to go try out our own way. And our average sales cycle is 35 days into education.
Wow, that's impressive.
And it was one of those things where we just took a different approach to the market. We got out there and, well, we got our audience to continue to think in their mind and say this is that man, these guys are really different. Like, everything about them was different. And that created enough intrigue. Mm-hmm. And that intrigue allowed us to get in front of them to actually do a presentation. Right? And then once we did the presentation, what we also found out is that if a school district really wants something, they can find the money for it. Mm-hmm. Right? And in a lot of cases, the reason there is an extremely long sales cycle or hard to sell into is that maybe your solution isn't that different from what they're using, or they don't feel like it's going to add enough value. That if it does, they figure out ways to do it, and that's been proof for us.
Right. Well, and it's kind of, you hit it on the internal process. If someone was coming from the industry, they would see, you know, nice, neat budget boxes and nice, neat products that fit into those budget boxes. And so you'd see this building block approach in which, you know, need was met with budget. And the approach you guys took was, you know, really being newbies to the industry and just saying, well, you know, this is how things have been done. We're going to try to show so much value that they're going to figure out a way to make it fit.
Exactly. And that mindset actually comes from not having experience in it, right?
Right.
It's hard for somebody to take that approach if they actually fully understand how everything works.
Right.
It's easier to take risk when you actually don't know how it's supposed to work.
Right.
And that was actually ended up being a big competitive advantage for us.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
Which is very counterintuitive, but that's what's
But it's true. It's one of those things that's counterintuitive, yet true.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's like, no insult to you guys at all, but it's kind of, you know, people in the industry will say, well, those guys are too dumb to know how this works.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, well, that ignorance means they're able to bypass this entire impediment of, you know, really limiting the way you think about things,
yes.
Right? So, like, when you're talking to, I have this experience all the time because my friends just get overwhelmed with me talking to them about different product ideas and business ideas. And they're like, well, this is how it normally works. And this is how these things typically happen. I think it's a real common fallacy that people have is that in order to be successful in business and bring a quality product to market, that you have to take the same approach that existing incumbents have taken. Right. And where they are today versus where they were when they started.
Yes.
And I think that's such an undervalued skill set and an undervalued really understanding of like, this is how you grow. I mean, it reminds me of the story about eBay.
Yeah.
You know, eBay was one of the first marketplaces, but people don't remember this. There were about four or five marketplaces at the same time eBay was there, and eBay was not the biggest. And so they had an interesting go-to-market strategy, or they were already in market, but they had an interesting growth strategy to really change the game. And it centered all around Beanie Babies.
Yeah.
They became the go-to for Beanie Babies. You know, so I think it's one of those examples where getting, like you guys, entering the market and getting, you know, enough market adoption to where that starts, you know, multiplying on itself, right? It happened the same thing when you're talking about just market adoption from consumers,
sure.
Right? Like,
yes.
There are many non-logical approaches to doing it.
Correct.
Yeah, and I think it's something that it's a skill set, really. It's a skill set of trying to understand how to take that approach and then, you know, ramp your growth.
Right.
And then take advantages of the scale when you get there.
Yes.
So Aptogee is a Little Rock company. They recently raised a $5
million. Yeah, $5.7 million, Series A in May.
In May. So for those of you that aren't, you know, well-versed in technology world, Series A is kind of the big funding you get that's, you know, once you have some substantial market adoption and you have a pretty well-defined product and you're starting to see some product market fit and you really want to grow. There have not been a lot of investments, venture capital investments, into Little Rock. So this is pretty substantial. This is a big deal for you guys and a big deal for the community. Since you were able to do this, well, let me back up.
Yeah.
When you were going through the process of raising this funding, did you find hurdles because of where you were located? Was Little Rock a detriment?
So Little Rock wasn't a detriment. We actually thought that it could be. Because you read a lot about in Silicon Valley that they want you to be there when you're fundraising. So what's happened is that if you try to raise money on the coast or in Austin or Boulder in a more mature startup market, that may be the case. But there is a whole slew of new venture capitalists in the world, and they're trying to go where there's less competition. And so they're trying to invest in what they call the flyover states, mm-hmm. right? And so they're looking for these software opportunities outside of the coast. We were, in the early days, we were introduced to some of these investors, and they actually do the majority of their investments in the center of the United States. And so we just happened to be there. It was just about making sure that it worked for them.
Right. And you guys took the investment from a group called Five Elms?
Yes. Right? Five Elms Capital. They're based out of Kansas City.
Mm-hmm. So what has changed since you took on that investment?
Get to breathe for a minute.
Yeah.
So it's weird because you get the substantial amount of money and you think you're gonna take it easy, but you know startups are just inherently very different than a typical business, right? Mm-hmm. I had my direct marketing business before this. We were a profitable 5-person business, right? It was great. This is a different world, right? Mm-hmm. The risk actually doesn't go down. We just actually go faster, right? So when you have X amount of dollars in your bank, you're going at X rate. But if you have 5X that in the bank, you're actually still, now you're going at 5X rate. And so the risk is actually just as big, or actually maybe even bigger, right? And so
I think it's definitely bigger.
It's bigger, right? And so as nice it is to have that, what you're doing is no different than what you were doing before that, which is trying to have those astronomical growth rates, and everything is about growth.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You're exactly right. Once you bring on that additional financing, the expectations from everyone change. The expectations from employees, the expectations from, you know, your new investors, you know, creating a board of directors where you actually meet regularly and actually have some corporate oversight.
Yes.
I mean, those are substantial changes. What has that done to the culture of the company?
So I think we're still pretty small now. So we're about 70 full-time people here in Little Rock. So we have a really strong culture, but it's something that we worry about is how that scales as we get to 100 and 120, because that's something that we do really well now. But just because we do it well doesn't mean that it's going to scale into that next stage.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And culture is one of the things that's so vital at early stages, and it's easy to mess it up. And I know you guys have focused a lot on keeping that culture. Can you tell us a few things about what you guys do to keep the culture within the company?
Sure. And I think culture has turned into one of those buzzwords, like the cloud.
Yeah, it definitely
the
has.
Big tech, right? And it's really what most companies used to call their values or their mission statement. Unfortunately, now it's become this buzzword, and everybody talks about how they have a culture.
And they think it means, you know, kegs in the office.
Exactly. It's not about that. And so for us, we were really focused on the employee and the worker. It's like we wanted this to be the correct step for them in their path as an adult. We have a lot of younger employees.
Right.
We also looked at work as a place, outside of sleep, the place where you're going to spend the majority of your time is at work, and it mm-hmm. shouldn't be that miserable place. It'd be something that you should enjoy to do. And we think the way to accomplish that is to help everyone at that company find some meaning in the work that they're doing. And whether that has to do with the actual task that they're doing or what we stand for as a company, like it didn't matter, but you've got to be able to find that.
Right.
And so in the early days, we, you know, write down our values and missions mm-hmm. and all this. And we looked at it and we're just like, you know what? That's not us. Right. And we went back to the table and we kept writing down different things. And the Netflix culture deck, it's online. It's really interesting.
It's great.
It's great. One of the things they mention in there is that if you're not willing to hire and fire by your values, then they don't mean anything. And I looked at our values and I was just like, am I actually willing to not fire somebody based on them not meeting this value? And the answer at that point was no. And so I knew that that wasn't good enough. So right now we actually finally got to a point where we talk about we want to build a culture of thoughtfulness and performance. And regardless of, you have to meet both of those to become a part of the team and also to stay a part of the team. And we finally got to the point where we're actually willing to say to ourselves that even if you are performing, if you're not a thoughtful member of the team and a part of our community, then maybe this isn't the right fit for you. But that was this culture isn't something that it's not an event that you do and you have a meeting. It's something that is, and culture is not something that you can rest on your laurels, right? Just because you do something well, like everything can go to crap very quickly, right?
Yeah.
So it's something that we were really focused on from the get-go. And I think there's some things that we do really well. Another interesting thing that I've heard about culture is that if you're killing it on your culture, your goals probably weren't high enough. Right? It should absolutely be a struggle. We're a work in progress, but at least we know what we're working towards.
Right.
Right.
So you've always got that extra bit to push for and get to a higher peak.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's interesting. And I've definitely run into that as well when you're talking about, especially around sales organizations, you can have just a complete rock star, right? Someone that is just really, really good at, you know, closing the sale, bringing in big leads, or, you know, and that it applies not just to sales. You just see this, I think, more in sales, but the personality doesn't always mesh with the team. And it seems like, to management a lot of times, that that person is worth some of the cultural issues that they might cause within the office. You know, some people might get their feelings hurt. But I think what you're advocating and what you guys are pushing for, and then also what's echoed in the Netflix deck that you're talking about, is that it all matters. It all matters.
It
absolutely
does.
You can't sacrifice cohesiveness for performance. You can't sacrifice thoughtfulness for performance.
Right, and it's not something that's just black and white. Right? This is something that you need to go back and address and revisit what you mean when you're talking about culture and what your values are and what you're willing to stand for. Like, this is very difficult to do.
Right.
Right, and it's something that if we need to adjust what those values are, then great, let's adjust it, right? Mm-hmm. Being a startup, like, everything that you do, including culture, is very iterative.
Right.
You just need to make a decision that it's actually something that's important to you. And if you can't sell yourself on why it's an actual value or a competitive advantage, then why would you do it?
Right.
Right. And that's the way a lot of times people convince themselves of, okay, let's talk about it. Let's put it down. But if they don't actually believe that they're actually going to be better off or reach profitability sooner or have a higher growth rate because of having the right type of culture, then it actually doesn't make sense to do it. And so for us, it was that I think our early team really bought into it and believed that it was something that was important that actually affected the bottom line for us. Yeah.
Right. Well, first, I want to commend you on thinking that way. That's a very progressive mentality to take in today's business environment. And it has real impact on the bottom line.
No, absolutely.
I want to shift into, you mentioned you have 70 employees now.
Yes.
And obviously, you guys are going to continue to grow. How has recruiting worked in Central Arkansas? What has been your experience with it? And then for the next 5 years and the different types of positions you're going to have to recruit, what is it? How do you view that in the light of being in Central Arkansas?
So far, it's gone really well, but we definitely have concerns for the future. Mm-hmm. Okay, with us, we were a pretty flat organization, but at some point, you have to start putting in, you have to professionalize a little bit more. And so what we ended up having is we had a lot of roles where you get in and you do the work.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were looking at, okay, what are the executive positions we need to fill? So we didn't have that middle management. And so at first it was a lot of outbound recruiting and referrals of our existing employees. Mm-hmm. And as we've gotten a little bit more press and people know more about us as a company here, we have a lot of people reach out to us. The hard part for us when people reach out to us is that we have this big gap in the middle where we don't have those middle managers. So it's like they're either having to take a step back and get in and do the grunt work,
right,
or might not be ready to take on an executive level role, right? And so now as we're professionalizing it, we're at about 50 plus, now we're adding a little bit more structure where we create more of those opportunities.
Right.
And then the other part for us is going to be, how do we continue to hire the developers that we need?
Yeah.
And then how do we bring on the right executive level talent, which is a big concern for us.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, I'll give you an example, you know, a VP of finance is something that we're needing, and there's plenty of great people with a finance background, but there's very few or hardly anyone here that has a SaaS background.
Right.
Right? And so we're
SaaS is software as a service.
Yes. 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 And so the accounting and revenue recognition on that is very different. It's something to where when you're hiring that level role, it's not something you want to train up for. You're hiring that level role for the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so can we go outside of the state and recruit somebody in for that? It's going to be very difficult and it's going to cost a lot more money. So, so far the recruiting has gone well, but we do have our concerns growing.
You touched on the technology piece of it. I'm curious because the state and then also the city has focused a lot on, you know, technology education, the tech park. How has that played into what you see as the current potential employees and then just kind of the technology mix, really?
Sure. I think that I'm glad those initiatives are happening. But as a startup, we need answers like right now.
Right.
And those will create answers for 3 years and 5 years and 8 years down the road. So I think those are things that need to be done. But as far as directly impacting us, I don't think it has a big impact. And one of the reasons is that I've always heard the statement that, hey, there's a lot of developers, right? They're everywhere. I was joking with somebody about this, is that we don't need a developer. We need a really good developer.
Right.
And the good developers, they're here, but they're in such demand, right? And the places that they're at are going to do everything in their power to keep them, and it becomes a bidding war. So there's actually a lot of great talent here, but the people that they're working with know that they're a great talent, right? And so it's hard to compete for that sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It always feels sometimes like the gulf between understanding business at a high level and in traditional industries versus, you know, software industries and startup, not startups specifically, but just kind of software companies. Like the difference between IT and developers. I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, oh, well, you know, the IT department does that. Yeah. Or, you know, we've got developers in our IT department.
Right.
And it's like, it's, you know, I think that's just part of being in a business environment that doesn't have a lot of experience with software.
Right.
They don't have a lot of experience with software companies.
Sure.
And so it's an interesting conundrum. And
no,
I always laugh when I hear people say, oh, the IT department will take care of that.
Yeah.
Just call the IT guy. So you've kind of given us an overview of kind of where you guys are now. Well, actually, let me ask you this. Where are your customers?
Yeah, so we are in 47 states, and we just hit 500 school districts.
Oh, congratulations.
Big deal for us. There's a couple of big players, you know, billion-dollar and multi-hundred-million-dollar companies that we compete with, and there's a lot of regional players. And we recently just surpassed the size of a lot of regional players that have been around over a decade.
Right.
So the growth is going really good.
That's great.
At some point next year, we'll be in 1,000 districts and want to continue to grow. For us, the important thing is also generating other products and services and that provide value to our existing clients. And that's going to be a big focus next year.
What does the education software space look like at a national level? And kind of where do you guys fit in that?
Sure. So right now, we fit more into the communication space. So your Blackboard, School Messenger, Edleos are the ones that we compete with.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as our target market, there's 25,000 private schools, 6,000 in growing charter schools, and 14,000 plus school districts, right? So there's plenty of market there.
Right.
But at the same time, it's not as big as just going after SMBs, right? And so that's where it's important that you can't just keep adding fuel to the sales funnel because there is a limited amount of people that you can target.
Sure.
And so that's why it's important that we develop other products in that as well.
Right. So going outside of the education market, possibly.
So that we actually get approached by quite a few people outside of the education market of how our solution would actually work really well for them. And so initially our thing was we had to stay focused.
Sure.
Right? People were like, oh, you're K-12, you can easily do higher ed. But it was so important for us to stay highly focused, and we're glad that we did that. So now as we're growing, we do have the opportunity to go into other industries. So we have this question of, do we go deeper into education or do we spread out to other verticals? And right now we lean heavily, probably 95% towards going heavier into education. The more that we're working with this industry, the more we like the people that we work with. Superintendents are amazing,
right?
And then it's also the more we see the opportunity,
right?
It's this little niche market that's sitting there that's very hard to break into, and we have figured out what we believe is the toughest part, which is distribution.
Yep.
And so we're just like, there's so much opportunity here, and it's actually something that really excites us.
Right. And I would imagine because the distribution part is so hard to break, once you get in there, you've got a lot of loyalty, you've got a lot of lifetime value, and then you've gotten over a wall that a lot of other people can't get over.
Yeah,
it's hard. It's really hard to get over there. So you've got some good barriers to entry from other players.
Yeah, so in the early fundraising days when we were raising our seed round, one of the things that kept coming up is, why would you want to sell into education? It's so hard to sell into education. And I was like, if I can prove that to you, go get a few clients. Like, that's actually our moat.
Yeah.
Right? Our distribution process is actually, you know, what's going to be a differentiator, what makes it hard. Mm-hmm. We love competing with the incumbents, right?
Sure.
What's hard to compete with is the up-and-coming startups that are copying what you're doing.
Yeah.
And there's a lot less of that in this because it's hard to break through.
Right.
Or they're taking the bottom-up approach, starting freemium and going.
Yeah.
Up, right?
Yeah. And it's not an obvious place, right? Like, it's not an obvious market to go after. Well, that's great. Well, Justin, congratulations on all your success. And congratulations on your twin girls as well.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Also a new dad. And I look forward to hearing more about your success. Thanks for joining us on the conversation.
Yeah. Thank you, Matt.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.